So, as it always happens, when I get invited to come here and speak, the date for the talk is set months and months ahead. And then, a couple of months ago, the request for a title and a topic came through. And I always say, it's always going to be about mindfulness and the Dharma. It's always about mindfulness and Dharma, but if you just say more mindfulness, more Dharma, I've been there, done that, I've heard that before, so I found something else to talk about this time. It's called mindfulness and the Dharma. And I wrote this topic. The Buddha said there are two kinds of persons rare in this world. One who takes initiative in helping others, and one who's grateful. So tonight I want to speak about rare and precious qualities of people in our life. And I want to reference the Mahamangala Sutta, which is the Discourse on Blessings, to look at the conditions for happiness or well-being, and to see how these rare and precious beings are important in our life, and to practice gratitude and proactive compassion is also the vehicle for our own awakening. Little did I know, or little did I anticipate, that over the past few weeks I've had a number of students requesting, calling me or contacting me in great distress, contacting me for help handling their overwhelmed feelings of related to the political discourse in the country and what is going on politically. And it's amazing how much time and energy and it can consume, and how distressed we can actually become. Probably some of you too have found yourself a little more engaged or entertained, or anyway, spending time. And I really didn't know what to say, except to look at the conditions that are leading to the distress. You know, there's always been different views and opinions in the world among spiritual leaders and government leaders and social leaders. So this isn't new, but what makes it now so overwhelming that we're exposed to these views and opinions? I didn't think it was helpful to just, you know, suggest that they resort to practicing equanimity in the face of what they were doing. So I suggested instead that they go on a news fast and to just turn off the news. Because most of us know there's an election coming up, and we know who we're going to vote for, and somebody's going to win. So, what's the problem? I mean, really, what can we do about it? Following the news cycle and allowing ourselves to get strung out and strung along and get all our buttons pushed, finding ourselves in a very reactive state of mind and not able to kind of unplug from the stimulus of it is not very wise and not really necessary, and it's not useful either. So a couple of people who did that came back to me and said, you know, a week without news is really a relief. You know, and then I suggested, well, there's one more thing you can do, and that is to act on your beliefs act on your wisdom. And if you really feel strongly about your own happiness and this collective efforts of all of us to have some kind of a social harmony that supports our happiness, then we have to, we can't be just passive recipients of the gifts and of others. We have to actually contribute to the process. And a couple came back to me and said, you know, I've never done that. I've never participated, other than voting, never participated in any kind of political endeavor, or even registering people to vote, or encouraging people, or speaking, or writing letters to the editor, anything. Never had done anything except vote. And I thought, well, that's that's not far from my truth too, although occasionally I do. And I thought, you know, this thing called communal life, having a community, whether it's your family or Ballard or Seattle or the United States or world community, takes a lot of effort, takes all of our effort. And I think it's important that we who practice the Dharma, practice mindfulness and value the teachings of the Dharma, bring some Dharma reflections to this whole process of creating this community and our participation in it, because it is such a important contributing factor in our life to the way we live and our happiness or our distress and the conditions of our life. So I think my talk tonight is influenced a lot by you know, the distress I have seen in, or have heard and been dealing with in some students. I think it's important for us to reflect on, what does it mean that we're going to have an election? What is it, what is being asked of us, really? Sure, it's just a casting of a vote, and it's a yes or no, it's a preference of one person over another, or one person over many others, but that's just the result of a lot of heartfelt work and life review and acknowledging what's of value to us, what really matters to me, and who best represents that. And I think if we don't do that, that work, the work from the ground up in our own heart, what's being asked of us from our heart, if we don't do that work and we just take our view of what's happening from the news cycle, we abdicate our responsibility. And we'll just have to live with the consequences. But I think if we participate fully in our own heart's consideration of what matters to me, what matters to us collectively, who do I feel aligned with, not just by the views and opinions expressed in the news, because that's such a small part of anyone, but really in my inner life, who would I consider my spiritual friend? And I know it's hard to look out there in the political arena and find and consider maybe anybody a spiritual friend, but who best represents the qualities of your own heart? Who best understands what's of value to you? Who best has the personal awareness of what you are aware of in your life as being important. And so I want to invite you to just inquire. I don't have answers. I'm not going to tell you how to vote. I'm going to ask you to vote, but I'm not going to tell you how to vote. But I would just like to inquire with you a little bit as to what matters to us, individually and collectively. Because, you know, when we vote and we elect someone, we're entrusting some part of our future with them. We're saying, you know what, this is what matters to me in the coming years, and I'm going to entrust you with some part of my wish to be happy, wish to be secure, wish to be respected, acknowledged. Because that's what we ask of each other. That's what we find important in practicing for ourselves. Can we acknowledge ourselves? Can we respect ourselves? Can we really do what furthers our own well-being? And who? And politically, who can support us in that? So when we hear the discourse, political discourse, talking about the future, who best articulates something of interest to you, something that matters to you, something that you think will support your growth, happiness, security, and maybe all of that together is your own flourishing. So, you know, we all want to live a good life. And I think the question to ask is, what is good about the good life? What is it that we want good in our life? I know when we say, I want to live a good life, easy to think, yeah, I want to live a good life. We all want to live a good life. And I think there's a lot of difference in what good is. And in the Buddhist tradition, or in our tradition of practice, you know, we say that faith seeks the good. Desire or craving seeks pleasure. And it's important to distinguish between pleasure and the good. And in our view of things, or I should say from the practice point of view, the good is really what's wholesome. What nurtures, what supports, what represents, what displays wholesomeness in our own heart or in our relationships with others. And sometimes sometimes to seek the good in our own life or to seek the good in our own communities is challenging. It may bring us into conflict with others. It may be very uncomfortable, actually, to consider what in our life is really good and what is not contributing to our own wholesomeness. We've all had to do, you know, any of us who've been practicing for any time at all have had to do a lot of deep work looking in our hearts to just discover what of our thoughts, beliefs, assumptions, opinions, behaviors, misbehaviors leads to the good and what doesn't. And we all have plenty of both, you know, just to be real about that. Nevertheless, we can still aspire to the good, and we can have faith in the good, and we can look for others who support, who call forth the good within ourselves. Because that's our spiritual companions. Those are our spiritual guides. Those are our spiritual mentors, if you will. Someone that we can have faith in is someone who calls forth the best within you, the good within you, the wholesome within you. Not that it's always easy. Rarely it's easy, actually. And so we shouldn't abandon this metric when we go to the polls or when we read the news or when we consider who's going to be in our life every day, in our face, you might say, every day for 4 years or more. And it's really important to look within our own hearts as to beyond the headlines and beyond the even the personalities, to ask ourselves, what are we willing to invest in this condition in our life? As you can see from the political discourse, there's a lot of unwholesomeness. There's a lot that calls forth righteous indignation and anger and condemnation and incredulity and disbelief and, you know, distrust. But we can't let that poison our own heart. This is the way it is. This is the way it is in the political sphere. So we have to accept, we have to acknowledge, this is the way it is, not to expect miracles, not to expect angels. Angels don't get elected, if there ever was one. So we have to work with what we got, and we have to watch our own mind, because if we succumb to overwhelm, if we succumb to cynicism, if we succumb to anger, if we succumb to any of those unwholesome states of mind, we disempower ourselves. We lose our center, and we give it to them, others. And it's hard to be satisfied, it's hard to be invested, it's hard to feel like we're really participating in our life if we do that. We give up. We throw away an opportunity to participate. But we have to be careful not to collude in the deception or the denial or the avoidance of a lot of the conditions in our life. You know, we live together, all of us. We live together. And anyone who's not speaking about the collective conditions that we all experience is in denial. And if we're not looking at that, if we're not recognizing that, we're colluding in that denial. We're supporting that denial. We're acquiescing to that denial. It's hard to get answers out of anyone, actually, sometimes. Nevertheless, we have to ask, because the footprint, the social footprint, the political footprint, the economic footprint, the environmental footprint, the spiritual footprint that we collective, this collective humanity called us, leaves on the earth is going to be around for a long time. It's going to affect a lot of generations. And we're responsible for this generation. We're responsible for this time in the unfolding of this experiment called humanity. It's us. It's not anybody else. It's us. You know, and we carry a piece of, you know, we are a product of the, you know, collective momentum of humanity. This long evolution has resulted in us. And what we do with it will contribute to the future. A lot of us have children or grandchildren, or at least nieces, nephews, or we know younger people. And when we reflect on the conditions of our life, how much things have changed in our life over the course of, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 decades, and then we add on our kids or nieces and nephews, and then their kids, wow, it's hard to imagine. And yet, if we don't imagine, how can we think that we're responsible? How can we think that we're caring for ourselves responsibly? The Native Americans, I've heard, or the First Nations people, I've heard, and I don't want to speak for them authoritatively, but I've heard that they used to consider the impact of their decisions 7 generations out. Hard to even imagine what 7 generations would be like. Even if they were short lives, it's still a long time. And I think that that's a very different consideration than what will bring me pleasure today. What will bring me a sense of ease today. So sometimes to consider these bigger questions in our life, both our personal life and our social life, because this thing called happiness, well-being, the good life, is not an individual endeavor. It's an individual and a collective endeavor. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is not a do-it-yourself thing. And it can't be at the expense of anyone else. So we're all in this together. And I think it's important to remember that, because everyone that's participating in the political process, as divergent as their views and opinions are, is us. Hard to acknowledge sometimes. But we're all heirs to humanity, to this evolution. And what matters to me matters to us. What matters to you matters to us. And I think it's important to acknowledge what matters. What really matters. I want to make a distinction between happiness and well-being. And partly this comes from Western psychology, but partly it comes from the teachings of the Buddha too. Happiness can be a pretty solitary affair. We all have activities that we can participate in or we can engage in individually and be happy. We can find our own forms of pleasure. We can find our own meaning in the world. We can find our own way of engaging with what brings us pleasure, and we can be happy. But well-being adds another dimension to that. Yes, there's pleasure. Yes, there's social pleasure, there's personal pleasure, there's economic pleasure, there's psychological pleasure. But there's also the what it takes to flourish, to grow, not just to indulge in pleasure, but to grow in fullness of being, to flourish, to become more, to bud and fruit from within, to become who we could be if nourished, so that we can flourish. And flourishing, or well-being, I should say, allows us, encourages us individually to flourish, but also others. Our flourishing must of necessity rely on, depend on others, and also nourish the flourishing of others. Because how we're engaged with others, how we're the nature of our relationships with others, how we create meaning in community and value in community, whether it's the community of the family or larger communities, or whatever it is that you feel affiliated with or aligned with in your society. These are important ways of nourishing, flourishing in ourselves and others. So when we act to increase our own flourishing, knowing that we also can simultaneously nurture or nourish the flourishing of others, then what is it that we need to do? So the Buddha spoke about these 38 conditions called the Mangala, 38 blessings, 38 conditions that conduce to happiness. But when I look over the list, I see that a lot of them are not just happiness, but nurturing, flourishing, and a sense of well-being, greater than just a sense of pleasure in ourself. So maybe it's a mistranslation, but to me it seems like the Mahamangala Sutta, the discourse on blessings, is really the discourse on flourishing, the discourse on how to establish, or what is it that contributes to our sense of well-being. And I think in this time of political decision, it's important to review some of them, just to consider, well, what is it that really nourishes our well-being? Out of the 38, there are a few categories. They fall into a few categories that I've arbitrarily, or I think with some rhyme or reason, collected them. A lot of them have to do with our worldly lifestyle, how we live in the world, the conditions that support how we live in the world. Some of them have to do with our own personal integrity, qualities within our own heart. And some have to do with our own inner resilience. Then there's the more Dharma-centric qualities, and we could call it spiritual, or we could call it Dharma, or we could call it awareness, or we could call it religious, if that's meaningful to you. But it's, what is the purpose, what's the meaning, what's the value of that whole dimension in our life? And then the fifth category is, how do we understand in a way that, what is it that we understand that nourishes our well-being? So some of these worldly lifestyle topics are interesting to consider, both in our own life, but also in the lives of those who are asking or hoping to lead us, hoping to represent us, hoping to receive our permission, if you will, to guide and nourish our flourishing. Of course, to reside in a suitable location. You know, we live in the West in the 21st century, and almost all of us here, I'm going to think it's fair to say, have we're living at the top of the heap. You know, we live with the abundance that the West has to offer in the 21st century, which is tremendous, maybe too much. Nevertheless, it's a suitable location for the discretionary time, the discretionary income, the access to the educational facilities that we have, and the access to all the spiritual traditions of the world. And there's no war here on our soil. We're all engaged in war. You know, when our country goes to war, we're all involved. Maybe we're not feeling the effects of it due to the distance, but nevertheless, we all go to war. So this is a suitable location to be well-educated, to be knowledgeable. We have had, all of us have benefited from the free if you pay taxes, free if you don't pay taxes, I mean, public education. And just to try to imagine what it would be like if we didn't have education in our country. And you know, there's a lot of places in the world that don't have the kind of education that we have, don't have access to it. So, you know, a lot of these conditions are things that we live with, so we've lived with our whole life. They're so ubiquitous, they're so understood as to be just part of life. We take them for granted. We almost fail to recognize that they are something unique to some beings and not available to others. I go to places in Burma, no, very little education. When your school is a tree, and you can sit under the tree, you know, on whatever days the weather's good enough to sit under the tree, and there'll be a teacher there. Maybe teacher. That's not much of an education. But that's the way it is, some places. And then to be able to care for your parents, the Buddha says, to be able to care for your mother and your father is a source of your own well-being. Now we might think, yeah, but that's a burden. I mean, we don't mean that really, but sometimes it feels that way. But think if your mother or your father or your children or your nieces or your nephews or anybody in your extended family needed care and you didn't have the means, the time, or the knowledge to offer it. That's suffering. That's real suffering. Even though we might want to, if the resources weren't there, if the means to that weren't there, hard to imagine. And then to engage in a harmless occupation. Yeah, we have this in our right livelihood of the Eightfold Noble Path, to engage in a livelihood that doesn't harm others. But you know, if we look very carefully at what it is we do, and just how it's funded, and who benefits and who's harmed by it, it's not easy to live in a lifestyle that doesn't harm others. A lot of it is reliant on. And if we have investments in the market, are we funding harming in some ways? It takes a lot of care and precision in investing to know that how we invest either encourages flourishing or it may encourage harming. And then to be generous. You know, to be generous with our time, with our knowledge, with our funds, with our experience, with our energy, with our love. This is part of our collective responsibilities or obligations for creating harmony in a community. So when we look to, you know, when we look to the political process and inquire who is it that has these understandings, that these conditions nurture flourishing. It's important to ask, you know, to look in our own hearts to see what's important, to recognize what's important, the conditions in our life, and also where it's available in others. And then those are the external, worldly lifestyle conditions, some of them. And then there's the personal integrity qualities that we value and cultivate, try to cultivate, but and recognize are immensely important in our personal relationships. Among them, first, maybe first and foremost, is to speak well, to speak words that are true, loving, gentle, beneficial at the right time. Sheesh. Okay. Anybody left? We know politics is a game, it's entertainment, there's a lot of BS, there's a lot of put down, there's a lot of, you know, it's competitive. And yet, still, even within all that, there are gradients of truthfulness, there's gradients of gentleness, there's gradients of what's beneficial, not. And we should,
it's easy. It's almost easy to be cynical, isn't it?
Or to be overwhelmed, or to just think, it doesn't matter. I mean, how could it possibly matter what I care about? And yet, if we all say that, if we all fall into it, if we all allow our hearts to be jerked around by the way it is, in some ways there's a collusion on our part that this is the way it is, and not that we accept it, but you know, there's a tremendous amount of deception in our society, in our culture, not just politically, otherwise too.
and it's ubiquitous. And we don't want to forget that. We don't want to pretend that it's not happening. Because then we lose our, you know, we lose our own integrity. And to sustain your own integrity of what matters to you is really important in your own flourishing. We can't control others, for sure. We can't control the process, for sure. But we can watch our own minds, hearts. That's what's important. And that's why this political season is a necessary time of being aware of ourself, our inner life. You know, this is where Sayadaw Tejaniya's teachings are most important, is to watch, to learn to watch your own mind in response or in reaction to everything that's coming at us. Because if we don't see our own mind, if we're not aware of our own mind's reaction to the stimulating conditions around us, we're lost. We're sucked into someone else's nightmare, or daydream, or fantasy, or wrong views, assumptions, beliefs that... And then we lose our own perspective. You know, we need to step back, and this is what a lot of practice is step back from the entangling of our own mind so that we can get a perspective on things. You know, to step back from the news cycle. You know, take a news fast and check out your own news inside your own heart. What matters? Who best represents your heart? Who best feels in who do you feel in alignment with? To act without harming, to perform blameless actions, to give selflessly, to abstain from evil, to avoid intoxicants, to be diligent in virtuous practices. Whew. You know, if we tried to hold any politicians to these standards, nobody would be running. So I think we have to be. I mean, these are important to us. And I don't mean to make voting a religious, spiritual thing, but it is something that represents our inner values. It's important to know that. And then the inner qualities resilience that we have and that we ask of our leaders, to be reverent, to be humble, to be content, to be patient, to be teachable, to be willing to learn. I guess we'll have to skip those. I mean, really, these are important to us. The Buddha said these are the conditions that nurture your flourishing sense of well-being. And if nobody is representing that, if nobody can do that for you, how do we participate? I'm just inquiring. I don't mean to harangue or, you know, not to lead anybody to a sense of helplessness or hopelessness. Because I personally have a lot of, I won't say hope, but I always think that the future is somehow we are co-architects of the future. You know, it's not forced upon us in any way. What's that word? There was a quote. Let me see if I got it here. People write their own histories, but not under circumstances of their own choosing. I get it. That makes sense. You know, the conditions are as they are, and we write our own history. We find a way to respond, to react, to work with, to grow with, to learn with, live with, and that's our choice. So given this is the nature of the political system, this is the nature of political process, this is the nature of how we as a community or nation create a community that has to try to live together. Huh? It's up to each one of us. Sometimes when I reflect on these qualities, it's really hard to even think that politicians, most of them are interested at all. And yet I can't believe that they don't have an inner life that is touched really sincerely, and that some of them do act from noble, wholesome motivation. I know. It has to be. Humans have that capacity. So it's up to us to, value it in ourselves and value it in those who lead us. The second thing I want to speak about is these two qualities of the rare and precious people in our lives. Those who are grateful and those who take the initiative to help others. Because I think that, just acknowledging all of the abundance that we live with, we didn't make it happen. We are living off of the fruits of others' lives. And if we can acknowledge that, if we can recognize our own gratitude for the way things are, the benefit in our life, the possibilities that we have in our life, then we don't so easily get caught in the bleakness sometimes that seems to be offered as a appraisal of the present and a view of the future. If we can just remember to, I hate to sound so simplistic or superficial, just count our blessings. And it sounds, I don't know, I think there's one of those religions that says count your blessings, but actually it's not a bad thing to do. Is to just recount and recall the things that today that we could be grateful for. And I don't mean just the fact that we're alive, but all the little things that we enjoy, taking all for granted, is really important. And gratitude has been studied as a contributing factor to happiness and a sense of well-being, and maybe maybe one of the most effective interventions for engendering a sense of well-being is to express your gratitude. And this has been tested over and over again in psychological testing, and to miss the opportunity to support our own well-being by not taking the opportunity to count our blessings or to express our gratitude would be, not taking care of ourselves very well. And what is gratitude anyway? Acknowledging good things in our life that have no reason to happen. Just acknowledging the benefit that we receive from anonymous others. Feeling joyful at unexpected goodness in our life somehow. Thankful appreciation for anything and everything, actually. One of the things I'm maybe most grateful for in my life is all of the mentors, benefactors, teachers that I've had who pointed me in this direction of awareness and caring about myself and others. And not to take it for granted, because there was a time in my life I didn't feel that. I didn't feel
That kind of support, that kind of guidance, that kind of purpose, actually, purpose in life. And to have someone share their values and point out to me their care, their concern, their the way they lived and why has really been important to me. And I think that sometimes we can take it for granted and fail to recognize who has contributed to our life in that way, whether it's partners or benefactors or mentors or kids or politicians, those who somehow brought something forth in us that has been good for us, someone that we feel indebted to, but in a way that you can't ever pay back. The other thing I want to speak about briefly is doing good, proactively choosing to support others, to be compassionate, to be generous, to be loving, to be able to offer our life in some ways to others. Why is that so rare? Why is that so rare that the Buddha said, "This is a rare individual, someone who can..." Let me find it here. "Two kinds of persons rare in this world. One who takes the initiative in helping others. Takes the initiative in helping others. When maybe we don't even recognize that others need help. Or maybe they don't know they need help. Maybe they don't need help. But still we can take the initiative in offering them something. Seems kind of ordinary, doesn't it? To want to help others, or actually to take the initiative to help others. Not even being called upon, not waiting for someone to call upon us, but to see that there's an opportunity to contribute something, to share something, to offer something to another. I eat in restaurants a lot, and you know, there's a kind of a stigma of going to eat in a restaurant alone, like, "Oh, you're so unlovable, nobody wants to eat with you," or something, or "You have no friends," or something like that, or "You got kicked out of the house and nobody to eat with." But I don't find it. I've gotten used to it, you know, whatever self-reflection or whatever I think others might think. And now I find that it's a great opportunity to make short-term instant friends. You know, somebody in the next table, somebody in the next stool at the booth, at the counter or whatever. And I have some really interesting conversations. And it's really fascinating to... you know, what is it that you're offering? What is it that I'm not offering anything? I'm just offering a human connection. I was just in Portland over the weekend, and I was flying back Sunday night and got to the airport an hour or so early, and I was just sitting down at the gate waiting for the plane. Had an hour, and a guy came and sat down beside me, and he opens up his iPad and he's reading away, and he's just totally immersed in it. And I was just kind of, well, not really bored, I was just observing people. And so finally I said to him, he says, "Wow, you really seem like you're really interested in that book, in what you're reading. What are you reading?" He said, "Oh, I'm really glad you asked." He says, "I'm reading the fifth book that my daughter wrote, just came out." So it gave him a chance to talk about his daughter and the fifth book that she just wrote. And he's totally lost in it. And
It was so clear. He was so proud and so interested to tell me about her in the book. The book wasn't anything I'd want to read, but nevertheless, it was kind of some kind of a sci-fi thing. But nevertheless, it was a human connection for 15 minutes while we wait until the plane got called that was precious. It's just precious to connect in that way with, I don't know anything about him, I'll never see him again. Nevertheless, there was this touch of humanity, this caring enough to share a moment, a few moments, and to actually, you know, it's interesting because the guy had on a military hat, you know, some veteran's hat, having been in the Navy or something like that, which has its own message, whatever it is. I'm not sure what it is, but it has some kind of message. But that was important to him. Nevertheless, we had a way of being together that transcended whatever differences we might have discovered about each other. And I think that, to me, this is really affirming of our community. To me, my participation in the community is to have these kinds of conversations with potentially not like-minded people. And I sometimes acknowledge kind of humorously or incredulously that I don't know anybody who would vote that other way. I don't know who they are, you know. And yet I probably meet plenty of them every day, people that are not going to vote like I do. And nevertheless, you know, they care. They're human. They've got their own values, and they're not wrong or bad. They may have different values, and it's important to understand that there is a common connection. There is a common life that we share with the other. And it's important to acknowledge that, or we feel like it's us and them. And when you go to the polls and it's voting for us and voting against them, you know, that's going to damage your heart. You know, be careful about that. See if you can find a way to understand that everyone is voting with the same intention as you are, somehow. Nourish your heart, your mind, and your body. Cherish intimacy and participate socially. Engage politically and believe spiritually. These are the conditions for a sense of well-being. And one of them is to engage politically. And here we have the opportunity. And, you know, again, in a lot of places in the world, engaging politically is more of a sham than it is here. I mean, it's not a sham here. We do get to participate. And yet, in a lot of places in the world, no meaningful voice in the government in selecting who's going to lead you, who's going to lay out the conditions for your, you know, your sense of flourishing in the next few years. So taking the opportunity to express our gratitude and to serve others, important political actions, and also a rare opportunity. And there's no reason that each one of us can't be that rare, or those rare and precious human beings in our collective community. It all depends, it all begins, it all revolves around being aware of your own heart, what matters to you, and then what's going on for you. If we aren't aware, if we're just kind of willing to kind of fall asleep in denial and avoidance and fear of confrontation or conflict or difficulty or challenge, it's hard to feel empowered in our own life. So it's kind of challenging, isn't it, to think, you know, we have to participate If we don't participate, we're kind of abandoning our own flourishing. If we do participate, it's challenging, it's conflictual, it's competitive, it's disruptive, it can lead to a lot of angst and but we're practicing awareness. We know how to deal with those kinds of states of mind. We've been facing them long before the political process rolled into high gear. And so we shouldn't abandon our practice, even in the face of these this intensity that we're facing, but to make this whole political process and our participation in it a practice of awareness. What can we learn about ourselves? What causes us to flourish? What causes us to diminish? And how to address that within our own lives and in our communal lives, whether it's family or larger community. It's really important. So I hope you'll all take the opportunity to take the remaining weeks before this next election and participate as fully as you feel motivated or can feel motivated or as fully as you feel that it's important to you or matters to you or that your own flourishing will be affected by your participation and by the outcome. Sayadaw Tejani again. You know, when your understanding of the nature of things grows, your values in life will change. Even when it's understanding the political process, understanding your own reactions to it. And when your values change, your priorities will change as well. And through such understanding, you'll naturally practice awareness more. And this will help you to do well in life. Well, there's more to be said, but I'll let you take some time to reflect on that. And if you have anything to say or to share, or your own response or reaction to the political process and how you're handling it, that could be interesting. Or if you have any questions, I'm sure I can say something about them. Well, thank you very much for listening. Should we do a survey? You know, we'll do a show of hands. Like, how many people here are going to vote in the presidential election? Yeah? How many who has not decided yet who they're going to vote for? The answer is zero here. Okay. How many are doing any other political activity besides voting? That's 10 or 15% maybe. So how come the rest of you aren't there? That's a question I have. If you don't have questions for me, I have questions for you. Doesn't it matter? Or do you think that it doesn't matter? Do we recognize how important it is? You know, I was talking to someone today, my therapist actually, about how, you know, in Dharma circles, we don't talk politics, you know? And I didn't want to talk politics, I want to talk awareness of the political process. And that's really what I'm talking about, awareness of the political process and its impact on us. Because it is a significant condition at play in our life all the time. We don't live in isolation of it. I was explaining to him, I said, Even the monk who lives in a cave, isolated from everybody else except to get his alms each day, is totally embedded in a society that understands and values what he's doing. As isolated and as solitary as that work is, you know, there's an understanding that it's only possible because he and they recognize they're all part of the same community, they're all part of the same process. So we too are embedded in this process, whether we know it or not, whether we want to participate or not, or whether we're just cynical or not, we're still, that's part of the process. Also, that contributes to it. Yeah. That's a really great comment. I'm just going to repeat it briefly for the video recording. You know, the question is, you know, those who awaken to the way things have often had to deal with situations and circumstances that are just as tumultuous and difficult and overwhelming as what we face. And, you know, at the time of the Buddha, there was a lot of conflict in society and even antagonistic towards him personally. So too with Jesus, with Martin Luther King, with anybody that seems to have grown in their inner life and have awoken to the way things are and have moved in the world in a wise and compassionate way. They haven't done it isolated from the difficult conditions of society. And it's actually the difficulty of the challenges that we face, the conditions that we face, that calls forth the deepest resources within us of awareness, understanding, and compassion. And if we don't open to the fullness of how difficult it is and how much suffering there is in ourselves and in others, and whatever wisdom we can access, these are the situations that pull it out of us, that draw it out of us. And so rather than waiting and hoping for a nice, quiet, calm, peaceful decade where you can finally do your practice to kind of finish the job or wake up or get wise, that's probably not going to happen. In fact, in Burma, you know, they say, you know, when you go to practice meditation, you shouldn't go to a nice, quiet, isolated, remote place. You should practice right in the midst of, you know, their center where I was practicing. There were dogs and cars and people, and it was just loud and busy and noisy most of the time. Because you really have to work hard to, you know, seclude your mind, to gain the stability of mind within yourself to deal with this very difficult and often unpleasant, challenging situation. But that's where you develop the inner strength
and cultivate these qualities that are needed as you come out in, as we come out into the world. You know, nobody ever floated through difficult times to and woken. Have had to accept the challenges of this is the way it is. You know, and it's difficult and it's challenging. It's not easy, and it calls forth reactivity or wise, compassionate responsivity. And the work is up to us.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll give you an answer and see what you
sure.
think about that. But personally, there are a lot of things I would rather do with my time. Just have a family or read a book or something else that I'm passionate about. There's 38 things on the list that you refer to, and only one of them is being involved in it.
Yeah. So that's a great comment. You know, I asked the question, well, why aren't some of you participating any more than just voting in the election? And the comment was that there are other things that I'd prefer to do. I could read a book. I could, you know, do things with friends. There's many things that you could do other than to participate politically. And that's also nourishing your flourishing, you know, or can be. Nourishing your flourishing. And that's true, and that's good. And I think if you look at, I don't want to say getting the most bang for the buck, so to speak, but seeing how much impact the political process has on your life and those who are in political office has on your life, you know, you could understand, you might understand that, wow, this has a lot of impact. And reading the book, I mean, you know what? It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much time to write a check and send it off to support somebody, or even to register to vote, or to write a letter. I mean, I'm not asking you to be a politician or even to organize, you know, spending all your free time doing that, but even to write a letter to a politician or a letter to the editor is very empowering. And it doesn't take that long. You know, I mean, it's just, you have to find your heart and put your heart to the pencil or the typewriter and send it. And the thing is, no one person, no one action is decisive. And that's just a fact that we have to kind of work with. But what's important is empowering yourself so that you don't feel disempowered or uninvolved or unimportant. I think a lot of us do at times feel like my vote doesn't count, my opinion doesn't count. What can one person do in this anyway? And yet, when I have taken action, whether it's write a letter or make a donation or speak to someone, it's very empowering. That in itself is nourishing. So I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying look at the impact that the political process has on your life. Be realistic in that appraisal, and then see if there's something that you would choose to do that's of value to you and also empowering you.
I just watched the movie Selma.
Watched the movie Selma? Yeah.
Which was basically about, you know, during the civil rights movement, the protests, which were about voting and the right to vote.
Mm.
And it was very humbling, actually, to see that movie. I mean, you know, people were basically dying. You know, this was 50 years ago, just the 50th anniversary for that right. And, you know, in this country, I mean, we think of it as, you know, going way back in time, but that's pretty recent. And so it really made me look at most of my time doing it. Mm. Is it on something important?
Mm.
It really raised a lot of questions. And just, you know, the movie really showed that people were willing to die for what was important, you know, to them.
You know, that's a good comment, too, about seeing the movie Selma, which is about the voting rights movement just 50 years ago, and how people who were so committed to ensuring that everyone had that right to vote, people were willing to die for that. Wow. I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? People willing to die for others to have the right to vote. That puts a value on our going to the polls, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. But you know, I've heard, and I think it's true, those who can't remember history are condemned to repeat it. And if you can't remember the challenges that have been faced in the past to secure us the opportunities that we have now, we'll lose them. We lose them. So it's hard to do, but necessary also. It's just like practice. If you practice and you develop some level of awareness or some momentum to your awareness and you gain some understanding of this is how it is for you, if you end that practice, if you break that practice, if you fall off in your momentum, you will lose that wisdom. It'll just be a memory. You may remember what you understood, but it won't be integrated into your heart and conditioning how you respond to life. Wisdom also impermanent. Wisdom impermanent. You can have a glimpse, you can have an understanding, you can have a lot of momentum of wisdom, and if you stop practice, then you'll lose it. Just like that. Yeah. Time for one last comment or question, or we can, yeah.
Maybe a little abstract, but I'm having some trouble distinguishing between recognizing the dukkha characteristic of condition, of human condition.
Yeah.
And aversion.
Yes.
But I'm a little confused about how to distinguish that from aversion and
judgment. So the question is about, you know, the First Noble Truth, the truth of dukkha, and the insight into the nature of all experience is that it does have the dukkha characteristic, meaning it's either painful, it's unstable, or it's oppressive, something like that. And the seeing that this is the way it is, and then not having aversion to it, or often being caught in aversion to it. And then the question was around what to do about that?
The unsatisfactory nature of the phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yes, 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 sure. Yeah. You know, even when we see that things have, all experience has this dukkha characteristic, and we look at it across, you know, across all the spectrum of life's activities, and it's quite natural in the beginning of practice to have a lot of aversion to unpleasantness. That's what's painful, that's what's oppressive, that's what's unstable, that which causes us to feel insecure and vulnerable and oppressed. Of course we have aversion to it. That's the uninformed, reactive mind. But as we practice and we recognize more and more, oh, this is the way things are, we grow in understanding, we
I don't want to say we accept it, but we are able to acknowledge this is the way it is. And, you know, we say experiencing dukkha is painful. Understanding dukkha is liberating. So when we understand, when we deeply understand the nature of dukkha, and the unsatisfactoriness of the ultimate unsatisfactoriness of all experience, that it's just not going to provide that stability that we want. When we understand that and we live in alignment with that understanding, then we stop pushing, we stop setting ourselves up against the truth of things. And then when we live in harmony with the laws of nature, this being a law of nature, when we live in harmony with the laws of nature, we stop suffering. We don't change the laws of nature. We stop struggling with the laws of nature and we stop suffering. So even though, yes, dukkha is a characteristic of all phenomena, and that is unsatisfactory, it's unsatisfactory in different ways, but we're also not asking for, with understanding, we're not asking for the kind of satisfaction that we might be when we're uninformed. We want to be stable, we want to be happy, we want to be pleased, we want everything to be okay. It's not going to be that way. Okay, once we can accept that and live in alignment with that, then we stop suffering. I know that sounds kind of paradoxical. This is the way the Dharma is sometimes. But the experience of unsatisfactoriness, when we experience it, personalize it, is very unsatisfactory. It's painful. And when we understand this is the universal nature of experience, deeply understand, it's very liberating. We stop expecting otherwise. We stop struggling. We might have to say that about the political process. So, you know, this is the way it is. Do the best you can. Don't expect it to be otherwise. And do the best you can. You know, if you understand it, then you can participate and not suffer more because of it. Thank you very much.